WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Each year is history in the making. That history comes in the form of people and events making news every day. So at the end of the year, it seems natural and fitting to look back and try to put things into perspective. When you go through an exercise like that, there are news events that seem etched into your brain. For those of us in Charlotte, one of those events is probably the Democratic National Convention that set up shop here in September. Another might be the dubious distinction of the Charlotte Bobcats becoming the worst team in NBA history. Those things we remember. But there are other things that we don't remember, and there are also something to be said for looking back to see how all of these events and newsmakers shaped the year and how they may impact our future. So we're going to be looking back at many things this hour with the people who followed it all. Several of WFAE's reporters were joined by Julie Rose, Lisa Miller, and Michael Tomsic from WFAE. And because this was such a momentous political year, we've invited Dr. Michael Bitzer to be part of this. He is chair and professor of history and politics at Catawba College in Salisbury, and the force behind WFAE's political blog, The Party Line. Welcome back, and welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Morning.
We're not going to spend much time on this, but we can't ignore, I don't want to ignore what happened on Friday in Connecticut. Diane Rehm is doing a show on this in the 10 o'clock hour. We are doing a program on this tomorrow at 9. But let's talk about, Lisa, CMS, their reaction to what happened in Connecticut on Friday, and what they've put in place, if anything extraordinary today, to put parents' minds at ease.
Well, I'm not sure as far as today goes, but immediately after the incident on Friday, they sent out a press release that says, basically, we routinely review safety procedures, crisis plans, evacuation maps to ensure that teachers, staff, and students know how to respond when a situation occurs on campus. So right now, I mean, what their security has been is that they do have police officers stationed in most middle schools and all high schools. Elementary schools, they don't have police officers. And they also, you know, it's an open door. All visitors have to go to the office. There are signs directing them to the office. And you need a visitor's badge when you're walking around the school.
Can you get in the building?
You can get in the building. Yeah. And, you know, you have to remember that it's a balance between making that school inviting for parents to come and be involved in their child's life and protecting the student. And in Newtown, what happened was that they did have a locked door policy, and it was a buzzer that was rung in. And of course, the shooter shot that window out and came in anyway. But CMS is going to be holding a press conference today at noon and talking more about their security protocol.
Did they talk at all about how they will explain this to children, particularly the younger children?
I've not heard word on that. Yet.
Okay. All right. Politics. This was the biggest event of this year up until Friday was politics. And the biggest story of 2012 in this area has to be, I think, the Democratic National Convention being in Charlotte. It came off without a hitch, put the city in a pretty good light. There were restrictions placed on the host committee by the president in terms of how they could raise money to host this convention. And evidently, there's still money left to raise. hard to raise a convention for an event that's already happened.
Already happened, yeah.
So how much money – does anybody know how much money is left
to raise?
It's about
$10 million left to raise. They're in debt, actually. They drew down a line of credit that Duke had backstopped for them. Typically, in the past, these lines of credit have only just been sort of for cash flow issues, kind of towards the end as everything's getting spent and the pledges are coming in. Well, they drew down on it because they didn't have enough money. So that comes due at the end of February. And if the DNC doesn't pay it off, if the host committee doesn't pay it off, then Duke is already actually in its last earnings call or earnings report sort of acknowledged the possibility that it could have to pay that, if the host committee doesn't come up to them with the money.
This is unusual, isn't it? I mean, because in the past, conventions have been allowed to go to corporations and ask for money. And
yes.
President Obama said he wanted it all to come in small chunks from ordinary people.
From grassroots. And, you know, this I think will post for future conventions this idea that, you know, it sounds great in theory, but the reality is you've got to have the mega money behind these kinds of events. And I think, you know, it was certainly put into the theme of the president's campaign, you know, grassroots, people-oriented campaign. But the reality is these things are just monumental undertakings.
It was a monumental undertaking, and they transformed downtown overnight, both going into the convention and coming out. Because the day the convention ended, you would not know it had been here. The next day, it was completely gone. What did it do for us, though? Did we get the media exposure that we'd hoped for? Did people in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, get anything more out of having this convention in Charlotte other than knowing that it was here? Did they know anything more about the city? Did they see any of us? Did it help us in any way outside of the immediate environment?
There's an economic impact study being done that is not done yet, that the city, the chamber, the Center City Partners, and the CRVA, the Visitors Authority, have commissioned. And they tell me it's going to probably be January before that's done. And they're hoping to quantify exactly what it meant for us in terms of spending. You know, the softer side, though, in terms of like if people know of Charlotte now, understand where we are now as a result of the coverage, that kind of thing. I mean, I think we were already sort of on that path prior to the DNC. And certainly there's additional awareness. The one interesting thing will be to see down the line if you get, because there was this very specific effort by the various economic development groups in Charlotte, the Chamber and Center City Partners, to make pitches to big corporate folks who were in town for the DNC, basically reach out to them, use it as an excuse to say, hey, next time you're looking to expand or relocate, we're great for that. Come check us out. So it'll be interesting to see over the next 6 to 8 months if we see any of that come to fruition. If down the line, I wouldn't be surprised if a big corporate announcement at some point comes along in the next year or two, and there is some mention of, well, we first started thinking about Charlotte because of the DNC.
I think it's a good test case. I mean, to look at opportunities to host these kinds of events. I mean, this is a rare event for major cities to host. And I think, you know, the opportunity that Charlotte had and apparently put on a very good face to both the national and international media is certainly going to draw attention and opportunities to host other big name events like this.
Organizers and city officials and not so city officials, people like Charlotte Center City Partners, which are not city officials, but they are boosters, were euphoric during and in the aftermath of this convention. I think the only blotch on the convention was the decision to move the president's acceptance speech from Bank of America Stadium to the convention hall. And the reasons given were the danger inherent in a possible thunderstorm that had been predicted, which, of course, did not come, although there were downpours the day of the speech up until several
which would have affected,
it.
In fairness, yes, all of those downpours would have affected all the people who were told they had to line up at 1 p.m., 2 p.m. in the afternoon for the 10 o'clock p.m., you know.
And would you really want, you know, the potential of a lightning strike in the stadium, people potentially getting hurt in that kind of weather situation? You know,
because there's no place to go.
Right.
First of all. And secondly, I think if the president has to leave, you can't for 30 minutes. If lightning was in the forecast, you'd have to go. But there were those conspiracy theorists who said that they moved the speech because they couldn't fill the stadium. Any truth to any of that?
I can't imagine. I mean, the understanding was the day of or the day before, they had already had tickets sold and given away, and that there was a waiting
list.
Redeemed,
right? Yeah. Like sort of people had to get tickets, but then you also had to kind of like RSVP and say, yes, I'm coming, I'm going to be there kind of a thing, and they're, you know.
Well, Michael Tomczyk, you reported on several people who had planned to be there and who had their hopes dashed by the decision. What was their reaction?
Well, honestly, I wouldn't even really necessarily call that. I mean, yeah, so it's the one thing that didn't go according to plan. But as far as putting a good face on everything, the people I talked to that night, it seemed like everyone that was not in the arena had a ticket to the stadium. Like, seriously, I think every single person I talked to, oh yeah, I'm supposed to be at the stadium right now. But and these were people. I mean, I talked to people from you know, as far away as Portland and New York and just Philadelphia and all over the place, and they all, you know, were saying, we're so glad we came. We've still enjoyed Charlotte. A lot of the people I talked to had not been to Charlotte before and said they've had a good experience there. Mm-hmm. And they were still enjoying the DNC. And I think, you know, as far as this is obviously just anecdotal, but I mean, anecdotally, there were a lot of people who had a good first time Charlotte experience through the DNC, even though, you know, they didn't get to go see the president in person in the stadium.
What politically came out of this convention?
I think one of the things I would point to is North Carolina continues to be a competitive state. You know, it went Republican. Romney won it by 2 percentage points. Florida went Democratic. So, you know, the Tampa Republican convention didn't necessarily help that state either. But I think it indicates that North Carolina looks like it's transitioning more closely to what Virginia is rather than South Carolina. And I think, you know, the grassroots mobilization, you know, that is key to these kind of modern campaigns now. And the convention probably gave the energy. Yes, it would have been nice to have had 80,000 more people energized on the ground if the stadium acceptance speech was there. But I think the opportunity to get the ground game mobilized and energized, that was something that the Obama campaign knew they had to do to keep the state competitive. You know, I think that was a key political activity.
You said we're becoming more like Virginia as opposed to South Carolina. What is Virginia? Because isn't Virginia fundamentally Republican except for Northern Virginia?
It is, but that influence of Northern Virginia, the D.C. suburbs, has become even greater. I mean, it's kind of like North Carolina in that 13 counties in this state deliver 50% of the votes, and they're the major urban areas. And so North Carolina politically is transitioning, has been transitioning from a rural domination to an urban domination, and that's going to continue.
On our political blog of the Party Line, Julie, you wrote that Obama's loss in North Carolina was a blow to local Democrats.
Hmm.
How so?
So, I mean, it was, I guess it was just sort of an ego blow. I mean, in 2008, they were euphoric for having changed, you know, the state to a Democratic one for President Obama. And I think the local Democrats felt like, and this was basically based on my conversations the night of the election, as they were realizing that President Obama had lost North Carolina, that it was, you know, it was kind of like, gosh, we did everything. We had the DNC. We were knocking on doors. We mobilized. Mecklenburg County went. And that's what oftentimes I would hear from folks was, well, we did our part. Mecklenburg County went for Obama. But, you know, the rest of the state didn't.
Did it come as a surprise to them, or did they see it coming down the pike?
I think they saw it coming. But, you know, one thing to keep in mind, too, is that when the DNC decided to come to North Carolina, and we heard all of these Democratic officials and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairwoman of the party nationally, you know, was very explicitly saying, we are coming to North Carolina because we are not ceding any ground. Those were her words. We are not ceding any ground. This is going to stay a state for Obama. And it didn't. So, you know, I mean, yeah.
But 2 percentage points is better than 13 percentage points in 2000 and 2004. Yeah. So.
The biggest story, I guess, politically in this state this year, among them, was the fact that Governor Perdue decided not to run for re-election. What was the impact of that on the gubernatorial race?
I think it just was a recognition that this cycle of Democratic dominance of the gubernatorial mansion was coming to an end. I mean, politics tend to, I think, go in cycles. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats had a very good run and held the governor's seat for a very long time. It was just time for, I think, the electorate saying, we need a change.
Had she announced earlier, would Walter Dalton had a better chance? Because he had to scramble to get organized.
He did. And maybe if it happened in 2011, it could have helped. But I think this was just the year that the Republicans were going to win.
We're going through 2012. We'll talk some more about the governor's race when we come back in just a moment or two. And then we'll talk about property revaluation, which is still a hot-button issue. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, blood supplier to 21 regional hospitals and thousands of local patients. Every drop stays here, saving local lives. Info about sponsoring a drive at cbcc.us. Well, no sane person walks into an elementary school and kills innocent children. No sane person shoots up moviegoers or murders people worshiping at a Sikh temple or at a shopping mall in Tucson or a college campus in Virginia. But in America, it keeps happening. And what used to leave us shocked and angry now just leaves us numb and wondering why people do such things. We look into the minds of madmen tomorrow at 9.
Sometimes it seems like the news industry is one big runaway train, headed way too fast, destination unknown. I'm Robert Siegel. At All Things Considered, we plan our daily voyage carefully and take the time to see the important sights along the way. Don't worry, we'll still get you where you need to go. All Things Considered from NPR News. Enjoy the journey.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Julie Rose, Lisa Miller, and Michael Tomsic from WFAE News, and Dr. Michael Bitzer. Too many Michaels here this morning. from Catawba College and our Party Line blogger, one of our Party Line bloggers here for WFAE. So Bev Perdue decided not to run late in the game. Yep. Why didn't she run, and do you think she regrets that decision?
It's hard to imagine that she would have won re-election with the poll numbers that she had and continues to have. I mean, she's only got an approval rating of about 35% now. It was hard for her to get renomination because she had less than half of her own base supporting her. So I think she read the numbers on the wall and acknowledged that this was not going to happen.
So he almost won the first time around, but he did win this time around. Longtime Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory won the race and will be the first Republican governor in a long time.
We're going to govern together, Republicans, Democrats, Independents. We're going to bring this state together, the East, the Piedmont, and the West. But we're moving to Raleigh soon.
He's also the first Republican governor, I think, in living memory to have a Republican legislature at his, I don't want to say beck and call, because I think they call the shots.
That's going to be the interesting dynamic in 2013. Yeah,
and the first governor since Jim Martin, I believe, to hail from this city or this area.
Who acknowledged it.
Yes, right. And we have Tom Tillis, who's the Speaker of the House from Huntersville. Mm-hmm. What will this mean for the great state of Mecklenburg?
Well, he's got to be – I think McCrory has to be careful. Perdue made a very, obvious and intensive coming to Charlotte oftentimes, opening up an office here. But he's got to be careful not to be seen as playing too much to his hometown, because the rest of the state still continues, for whatever reason, this kind of animosity towards Charlotte gets everything, we don't get anything.
So might we get short shrift because he's being careful?
It's going to be a delicate balancing act. I mean, he's already acknowledged he's going to Asheville right after his swearing in to kind of visit the western part of the state. The East is going to want their attention. Raleigh and the Triad area is going to want their attention. He's got a lot of things to balance. And this whole push of being, open to both Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, his first couple appointments so far has seemed to indicate he's leaning much more on the Republican side than – maybe he'll bring in some Democrats to key cabinet positions, but it's going to be an interesting balance.
What else are these early appointments indicating about what kind of an administration he might intend to have?
Well, Michael, one thing, on the point of, trying to focus across the state, I mean, his chief of staff, Thomas Stith, was a three-term Durham city councilman. And when he was at he worked at a UNC Chapel Hill think tank. Like, I don't know if worked is the right term, but he led that think tank's economic development efforts for the eastern part of the state. So, I mean, to me, that's another signal that, he's trying to kind of walk very delicately about, where he's going to be focusing and spreading out that focus.
Lisa, again, on our Party Line blog on WFAE.org, you wrote that in his victory speech, Pat McCrory saluted some of his mayoral predecessors here in Charlotte, Eddie Knox, Harvey Gantz, Sue Myrick, Richard Vinroot, who had all run for statewide office and all lost. And McCrory said the curse is over. Has something fundamentally changed in North Carolina, or was it just time and or just the fact that he ran 4 years ago and really hasn't stopped?
Well, I think you mentioned Jim Martin before, and he was a Mecklenburg County guy, and maybe he, you know, he said he was from the Lake Norman area, so maybe he was trying to get that perspective across. But I think that he was the Republican running, and the Republicans had a lot of force going into this election. He's been also running for 4 years, for a number of years now. So, after he lost to Perdue last time around, he's been out on that campaign trail,
which obviously gave him a leg up, certainly on any latecomer who would come into the race on the Democratic side, including the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, very much.
We have South Carolina listeners, too, and it's a big day in South Carolina today. Senator Jim DeMint has decided to step down from the Senate and go to the Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing think tank. Why would he do this after this election? Why would he leave the Senate? Senate's a pretty prestigious place to be.
It is, but DeMint has never been known as a legislator. He is much more of the kind of ideologue in the Senate. And I think he sees people coming into the Senate that share his perspective. And the interesting statement in his decision to step down was, I want to focus on local and state activities. He, I think, sees the national polarization and gridlock in Congress as not being able to get anything done. He sees, I think, the action occurring at the local and state level, and that's where he thinks he has the greatest influence.
So Governor Nikki Haley promises to appoint his replacement sometime today.
Sounds like noon today. There will be a press conference in Columbia.
And the front runners are Tim Scott and, believe it or not, Jenny Sanford, who is the former governor's jilted wife.
You know, somebody told me the best revenge is a U.S. Senate seat.
What is significant, aside from the fact that she's the former governor's wife, what's significant about these two potential people?
If Tim Scott, a congressman from the Charleston area, is appointed, he will be the first African-American U.S. senator from the state of South Carolina. If Jenny Sanford is, she will be the first woman to hold the Senate seat from South Carolina. So this is and the political director for Nikki Haley has already tweeted out today will be historic. So one of those two options, it seems like, is going to happen.
And if you roll back the clock, I mean, Mark Sanford was a U.S. senator before he was governor of South
Carolina. U.S. House member.
Right. Jenny Sanford is not just the ex-wife of a governor.
She ran his campaigns. She is very well tapped into the Republican Party establishment there. So this This would not be out of the ordinary, but it is a kind of surprise name.
Where's Mark Sanford? Anybody know where he is?
On his farm in the Low Country, isn't he?
I believe so. Planning a wedding, maybe.
Engaged.
Is Argentinian.
Any shot? Any chance that it will not be either of these two people?
It's hard to imagine. Henry McMaster has apparently already been told that the former attorney general who was in the top five, that he would not be the nominee.
Was Nikki Haley in the top five? Because she could appoint herself.
She would have had to step down and then cut a deal like what was made in the 1960s. She said she wouldn't. So.
Yeah. Well, we'll wait to see what happens later on today. You can hear it here on WFAE. We're going to move away from politics for just a minute and talk about something else that's been a really hot potato for local officials and property owners. And lots of sore property owners at that here in Mecklenburg County. Property revaluation happens by law once every 7 years.
Julie, at least.
What happened this time that got people so upset?
Well, I mean, it's the county that makes this decision. And honestly, I mean, the county was going to lose either way. Nobody was going to be happy with what was going to come out of this because they had waited the maximum amount of time to do this. And in the interim, all kinds of things. We had a boom and then we had a bust. And so basically, a huge number, a historic number of people appealed their assessment. It completely overwhelmed the volunteer appointed body, that the Board of Equalization Review, that's responsible for sort of handling those appeals. there was so much noise that, of course, we had this outside independent audit take place, which we've only just recently learned the details of. And it turns out that probably they're estimating that in 10% at least of neighborhoods around the county, some serious problems with equity occurred in the assessments. One of the things that they really underscored, these auditors, was that specifically in neighborhoods where that are older and that are heterogeneous, those are the areas where there were real problems, that nobody had been out from the assessor's office in 17 years to actually look at properties and make and say, okay, yes, this matches, this house matches with what's in our records and the assessment jives, you know. So because what you basically had was all of these people coming to these hearings and saying, how can you possibly say that my property on this side of the street is worth the same as my neighbor's house across the street who's rebuilt in the last 2 years? Like, how you know, this is not logical. And so, yes, the review came back and said that that indeed was the case in a lot of these neighborhoods, specifically anything that was built sort of after 1980 in these like developments where the homes are all very much the same. Those tended to be okay under the statistical model that the assessors used, which was a state-approved, acceptable approach. But it was the older neighborhoods that had some real problems. So, of course, we saw the assessor lose his job.
Yeah, is the county to blame for this, or is it the assessors that they hired or that worked for the county who are to blame for this?
We're seeing some spreading of blame. I mean, County Manager Harry Jones says the buck stops with me because he oversees the whole whole situation, mm-hmm. right? The assessor has been reassigned to another office in the county. At this point, there is a fix underway, a fix to the values. So what's happening is you've got Pearson's, which is this independent audit company that is widely respected across the state and has been very well praised by homeowners here in town as well as county officials. So it's basically going to be the de facto assessor's office for the next probably year as they go in and try to fix the values in the neighborhoods that were problems as much as 10%. But the county cannot retroactively change your value. So if you've been paying the wrong amount of taxes for the last 2 years, you're not getting a refund and you're not going to get assessed for higher taxes if you were paying too little. I mean, and they say that that could very well happen, that when they go back and reassign these values, some homes were undervalued.
But going forward, you will pay whatever
going
they
forward
decide.
You will, but
will there be an
the
appeal
refunds.
Process to the appeal process?
Yes. There will – well,
never yeah. going to end.
Yeah. No, it's going to go on and on. I mean, the appeal process. But one of the also interesting things that did come out of this review was that it's expected that you're going to make mistakes. But had the reviewers said, the auditors said, had the county handled the appeal process effectively, mm-hmm. all of this outcry and this additional audit could have been avoided. And the thing that they really pointed to was the initial process, because there's like three stages of appeals that you go through. When you first get the letter, you can submit an informal appeal to the county staff. That process was bungled, said the auditors, that if they had – you couldn't come in person. You couldn't talk to somebody in person. You can only just submit this paperwork. And then the majority of them got rejected anyway, your appeals. Then you had to go to the Board of Equalization and Reviews. That was like an in-person hearing. That process was not handled effectively as well. And then now we've still got at least 1,000 people who are appealing to the state. So they're going to improve the appeal process in theory, mm-hmm. and that should make things better the next time around.
When will people who have been appealing this ruling know what's going to happen?
Well, they should already know. I mean, the Board of Equalization and Review has already decided on all of the initial appeals for 2011. But about 1,000 of those people have said, I am not satisfied with what you said, told to me. I'm going to the State Property Tax Commission. And those are still in process.
So they have to do this every 7 years by law. And they put it off to the last possible minute, I guess because of the recession.
We're not going to see that again, I don't think.
So they're going to do it more frequently, you think?
That was one of the recommendations of the auditor was, you need to fast track doing this again. I mean, as early as 2014. We'll see.
DSS, the Department of Social Services, was another county problem this year with the director, Mary Wilson, being fired. She appealed. She lost that appeal. And further investigation also turned up allegations of problems within the department's Child Protective Services division. Michael Thompson, recap that whole situation for us.
Right. So obviously the Charlotte Observer has done a very thorough job covering this, and they were able to actually turn up some documents that showed that Youth and Family Services, which is the division that is responsible for abused and neglected children, had just been dealing with a lot of dysfunction and even missed some federal standards. And you know, some of these things came out in, for example, a consultant's report that showed widespread problems in that division. And the Observer only uncovered that. It was paid for with taxpayer dollars, but some of the county commissioners didn't even know about it. And it was not, you know, made public initially. So, I mean, it was just, it seemed like, you know, there were a lot of just problems in this division, and even county commissioners, who I guess technically are the people who, you know, have that oversight of DSS, mm-hmm. even they weren't aware of some of the issues that were going on. So,
and they are the supervisory board here. Before her dismissal, Ms. Wilson had red flagged another employee, the one that was in charge of Child Protective Services, and recommended that he be removed. And in fact, he was removed, but not from the department, from her control. And they moved it downtown to the city, the assistant city manager, I think. He's still there. She is gone. Have we gotten an explanation of all that yet from anybody?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
You know, one thing, though, that to mention about this, just kind of bigger picture, that the fallout from the DSS thing, while they're, you know, they need to obviously address what's the safety of children is the priority. But this is this has had already a pretty significant impact on Harry Jones, the county manager.
Yes.
I mean, one of the reasons reportedly that the county commission decided not to give him a raise this year, basically, you know, angered him, rejected his request for a raise, was because of that situation, the mismanagement there, and that, you know, that there was not enough accountability between the county manager and him telling stuff to his governing body, which is the county commission. So
this is another in a series of things where he looks like he's out of touch, and he has been ill. Do you think that's part of the problem?
You know, I don't know what went on in that closed meeting where if they addressed his illness specifically. I mean, he has not been absent very much. I mean, it's been remarkable how much around for dealing with the serious cancer that he has. And I think, you know, he's not using it as an excuse either, saying, hey, look, this was a bad year for me. I mean, he has not used it as an excuse, and I don't think the county commission is using it as an excuse either. I think that they're concerned about, you know, making sure that they know exactly he's been very capable. I think that part of the county commission has felt like, hey, you know, we've got this guy. He's good. We're going to let him do his thing and stay out of the way. And now I think they're realizing, look, we need to make sure we're also in the loop on what's going on.
Like a bad clutch, we're going to shift gears here and hear the grinding of the wheels.
There's just some breaking news coming over. The New York Times is reporting that Tim Scott will be the pick by Governor Nikki Haley in South Carolina to fill Jim DeMint's Senate seat. The New York Times website has that as breaking news.
Okay, thank you. I was going to go back to politics, and now that we're there.
There's the clutch.
Before the Supreme Court decided to take up two different questions surrounding gay marriage with a decision in June, North Carolinians voted for a state constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. Did that come as any surprise to anybody out there?
I don't think it did. I mean, North Carolina is socially conservative. I think, you know, a 60-40 split was something that people, at least I was thinking maybe it might be a little bit closer. But
how did young people react to this, Michael? Because you were at UNC Chapel Hill at the time, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, of course, UNC Chapel Hill is, you know, this little liberal bubble anyway. So, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there was a lot of opposition to the amendment. But one of the things that stood out to me was just how many different student leaders and then just students in general that I talked to who said that passing was a factor in their decision to then figure out where they want to live once they graduate. I mean, I talked to a decent number of people who said I'd rather not be in North Carolina.
Could either of the Supreme Court decisions have the potential for overturning this amendment in 10 seconds or less?
It would be hard to see that. Tom Tillis said in 20 years that's probably going to be reversed.
We're going back to Chapel Hill. We're also going to look at the Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools and a couple of other things that made the news here in 2012 when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Spark Publications, helping local professionals to creatively custom publish their own books, hosting a January 18th seminar on custom publishing. More info at the seminar tab at sparkpublications.com. A massacre at a Connecticut elementary school has left us once again asking how we can stop gun violence. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about the effects of mass shootings on the American psyche in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue going through the news events that made our world what it is today in 2012 with our panel of WFAE journalists and Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history at Catawba College, when we come back.
Hello, I'm Roger Sarrow. The WFAE staff and I would like to thank the 520 listeners who called in during our one-day end-of-year campaign. Some became new members, others chose to renew or make an additional gift. If you did not have a chance to call, you can still make your end-of-year contribution at our secure website, WFAE.org. Thanks and happy holidays.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Julie Rose from WFAE News is here with Lisa Miller and Michael Tomsic, also from our news department, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, who broke the story just moments ago from the New York Times. We have all these
news people here.
We have all these news people here. We get Dr. Michael Bitzer. You're hired. The job is yours. Broke the story.
We should say, Mike, that he's sitting here with his iPad open to the Twitter feed. Yeah. I mean, he is a Twitter addict, if there is one that exists.
Absolutely. And the story that he broke is that the New York Times is reporting, and now CNN is also reporting, that Tim Scott will be the nominee or the appointed senator in South Carolina that Governor Nikki Haley will appoint later today.
Correct.
Okay. Lisa, Dr. Peter Gorman suddenly departed last year or this past year and went to the education division of the News Corp, which is the company that owns Fox News. He was replaced by Heath Morrison, the former superintendent of a school system in Reno, Nevada. He's been on the job now for just under 6 months. How have things changed, or have they?
Well, things are starting to make changes. You know, first, when he came here, you heard a lot of him saying, I want to first listen before I'm understood. Mm-hmm. So he embarked on this listening tour. He held a bunch of town hall meetings, not just with teachers, but with the community, to try to gauge what he was hearing from people, what he should be doing. And so now, in the last couple months, we're seeing some changes taking place. The first sort of big public change that we saw were a couple audits that came out. There was one with the HR department, and it was a pretty harsh audit, you know, saying basically they weren't getting people into jobs fast enough. They were not reacting quickly enough. So they replaced the HR director. The communications audit was also pretty scathing, too. They're trying to be more transparent these days, they say, more proactive when it comes to that. So they've also have a new communications director as well. And a few weeks ago is when Dr. Morrison laid out his big plan for the district about how to improve schools. Wants to, and this is not new things. You've heard him say a lot of these things before. But for example, narrowing the achievement gap between struggling students, between African American, Hispanic students, and white students, but also really looking at trying to get kids who do very well to continue to do very well and do better. And when he first came here, I talked to him back in July, and this is what he told me.
A great school district is going to have great performance across 159 schools. There's not going to be gaps based on race, gender, socioeconomic status, and that really what we do is we prepare kids for a future where the vast majority of them are going to need not only the high school diploma, but some sort of post-secondary education.
So he said, basically how to do that is you got to get good teachers, you got to make sure they stay, you got to have good training programs. He's started a project now where he's identifying kids who should be in AP classes and trying to get them into AP classes. more of this real-time remediation. So mm-hmm. when you see a student who's starting to struggle, you get that student right there and then. He's also calling for, you know, and a lot of this stuff is just beginning to take shape. So it's kind of hard to see where mm-hmm. this is going at this point. But creating more magnet schools, he says, you know, hey, we need to have a lot more choice in CMS. So we need to look at more magnets. He's also trying to coordinate private schools and charter schools with the public school system, get people at least talking together to see, you know, how maybe CMS could help them out.
That happened last week, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of, it does not, I have not heard of that happening, you know, in the past.
Why would he do that? Because money comes from the public school system to fund the charter schools. And I've forgotten the exact figure, but it's several thousand dollars
per
student.
Yeah, it's at least about $5,500.
And he said basically last week that if charter schools could benefit by using the buying power of CMS, he mm-hmm. would be happy to do something for them. If they need to buy textbooks and the CMS gets them cheaper, then they'll buy them through CMS and get them cheaper. Why would it, what's in it for CMS?
Well, he says, hey, if we can help them out and there's no expense to us, mm-hmm. why not?
Okay.
And so that's the attitude he's going in there. Now, you know, a lot of these changes, I asked him, you know, how much do you think this is going to cost? Because a lot of this, you know, seems like it would take some money to get this done. And he said, well, I'm not putting a price tag on this right now. A few teachers I spoke to, you know, after his big presentation said, you know, they like the idea of this is a new start. You know, mm-hmm. we feel good about this, but I don't know how this is going to happen. You know, I don't know how much this is going to cost. So he's trying to work those discussions as we go into the budget season.
So new leadership at CMS again this year, but a body blow to higher education because North Carolina is very proud and has traditionally been very proud with justification of the university system and of Duke University being here as well. And there were problems at UNC Chapel Hill that tarnished the reputation of a great school this year. Michael, you're an alumnus. This stemmed from several athletic scandals at the school and resulted in, among other things, the resignation of the chancellor there.
Announced resignation, yeah.
Yeah, Holden Thorpe. Now, he announced that people want him to stay. Has he decided what to do yet?
Oh, he says he's going. Okay. His explanation for that is basically just kind of this ongoing toll that it's taken on, you know, the university and on him has just gotten to be too much.
What was the straw that broke the camel's back here?
It's the fundraising scandal. So real quickly, this all started 2 years ago with football. The NCAA caught some former UNC football players cheating in classes, taking gifts from agents. That spilled over into the Department of Afro and Afro-American Studies when, you know, an internal investigation found some of the instructors, they were basically just kind of giving out grades. So then most recently, this was just a couple months ago, it was fundraising. A vice chancellor, Matt Kupek, who's the university's top fundraiser, he resigned, and so did another fundraiser, Tammy Hansbrough, and that was after UNC caught them paying for personal trips with university money. If Hansbrough sounds familiar, she's the divorced mother, I should say, of former UNC basketball star Tyler Hansbrough. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that fundraising scandal broke, the UNC Board of Trustees, who are some of Thorpe's bosses, had one of their regularly scheduled meetings. So we went there, and at that meeting, they said they still had confidence in Thorpe, but after it, I asked Thorpe, you know, about the feedback he'd been getting from his bosses, and here's what they said.
They're concerned about the toll that it's taking on me and on the institution, and they're frustrated that things like this are making it hard for us to talk about the positives at Carolina.
And as we found out 3 days later, apparently that toll was enough for him to decide on his own he was going to step down.
How long will it take Carolina to recover both their reputation and rebuild their athletic program?
It's a tough question. I mean, this Thursday we're actually going to find out about the study that former Governor Martin led to kind of take another big look at this and see what the lessons are. Mm-hmm. Thorpe has said he's going to focus the rest of this year on trying to make changes, that these things don't happen again. But, when you get that little tarnish, I mean, who knows how long it takes to, you know, I guess wear that off or get past that.
I don't want to have this hour end by bypassing the Monroe Bypass, so let's talk about the Monroe Bypass. It was a topic of discussion. One in Gaston County. There were two bypasses.
Yeah, it's
one's
been a
in
rough
Gaston
year
County,
for
one's
toll
in
roads.
Unicast. Yeah. The Federal Highway Administration took back, I understand, their approval of the $700 million Monroe Bypass toll road. Why?
Well, there was a court appeal. Basically, a federal appeals court ruled that the environmental assessment that the state had done which is the required document that that the state must do to say this is how this road is going to affect the environment, the communities, all, you know, all that stuff on this. And this is, of course, the road that's going to go clear out to Marshville, like beyond Independence down. That there were flaws that the court, and this all stemmed from a lawsuit that was filed by the Southern Environmental Law Council, SELC, basically saying, because they went back into the documents and they alleged, and the court agreed, that in fact the engineers for the State Department of Transportation, when they did their assessment, they used build against build numbers. So you're supposed to look at, like, what would the difference be if we built this versus if we didn't build it? Right. But that ultimately they ended up comparing if we built it versus if we built it. And and then you get a zero effect, because yes. Amazing is that. Now the DOT has said, look, it wasn't exactly like that. They disagree with the court's ruling. But the bottom line is that the Monroe bypass is indefinitely delayed. And the Garden Parkway is on the ropes, too, which is the one that would go over on the other side of the county that would connect just I-485 close to the airport. It would loop along the southern part of Gaston County and then come up and hit 85 out past Gastonia. So that one is also kind of in limbo, and the state has withdrawn a couple of the permits that it had submitted for that because it's waiting to see how this litigation with the Southern Environmental Law Center.
How much of this is unusual, and how much of this is just the way things work when you're trying to build a highway?
Lawsuits are always going to happen, and they're long processes. You know, the details around these two, I think, are a little bit unusual. And what's unusual is that these are toll roads, and North Carolina has very few toll roads. We're in an era where money for roads is slim, and they're looking for other ways to try and get these roads built. And so that just adds an additional wrinkle that these would, in theory, be paid for by the tolls collected down the line.
Let's race through the sports score. The only winner among our professional teams in Charlotte this year were the Charlotte Knights, because they're going to move to Charlotte. They're getting their stadium, and ground has been broken downtown. So, Julie, where are we with that?
It's construction underway. They're going to be playing in 2014. That's their plan, spring of 2014. They need to basically immediately double their attendance and revenues in order for this process to
work. They say they will, and they say that's they're getting. The team will get an The team's economic boost will be $38 million by moving downtown. Charlotte Center City Partners predicts $300 million in new development around the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
How much
we'll see.
Do we believe these predictions?
We shall see. There are significant flaws in any prediction like that.
The first pitch will be thrown downtown.
April 2014 is the plan, and it's important to note that the Knights did get a public money commitment, both from Mecklenburg County, about $8 million, as well as from the city, again, about $8 million. But none of that money comes to the team until they throw that pitch and are playing downtown. So, you know, in a lot of ways, the Knights bear the full risk of this endeavor.
The Bobcats, worst team in the NBA last season, which ended this year. Michael, that's a terrible thing. but given attendance, did anybody notice?
Oh, gosh. Oh, man. I guess that's a fair question. I mean, I kind of think of them as the record-breaking Bobcats, because they took that record last year and then used it to break another record this year.
Yeah.
It took them the fewest games of any team in NBA history to match their win total from the entire previous season. If you were counting, it took all of 12 games for them to win the total number of games they won last season, which was 7.
Now, we talked about this last week. Will they become the Hornets 2.0?
I don't see why not, honestly. I mean, the New Orleans is becoming the Pelicans. It just makes sense. Everybody is still obsessed with the Hornets deal, and that name still has some buzz.
Back page of the sports section this morning in the Charlotte Observer is a full-page open letter from a PSL owner who is ticked off. And he is he's essentially calling the ownership structure of the Panthers a pyramid scheme designed to enhance Mr. Richardson's bottom line at the expense of everything else. Have you seen that?
No, I missed that.
Well, you ought to get the paper and read that letter, because people are ticked off about this losing season again and about hiring coaches who have no experience, et cetera, et cetera. They are beginning to win. Big win yesterday against San Diego. Anything to say about the Panthers?
I think I would be very surprised if Ron Rivera is not out of a job at the end of this year.
You think?
He said earlier this year, basically, he doesn't even know what's going to happen after this season.
And I'm not a sports person, but I do look at public financing of stadiums, and the Panthers are trying to remodel significantly their stadium. They are going to be, they're meeting with city council people. There's going to be a public ask, and it's harder to make a public ask when you're losing. So there's
Duke Energy merged with Progress Energy, made the biggest utility company in the world as a result, but it turned sour moments after the merger. They fired the guy who was going to be the head of the new company and put Jim Rogers in place, and now he's going to be out at the end of next year.
Right.
Julie, what's going on?
Well, the year started with a setback. They hoped to close by January 1st. That didn't happen because of some regulatory delays and concerns regarding their monopoly status in wholesale power. And so, then the real big thing that nobody anticipated was the was this CEO switch, which then launched this gigantic investigation by the state regulators and some really, really unusual hearings that were very tense and kind of ugly. So I think we have a little bit of tape here of Jim Rogers testifying about why one of the reasons why they decided not to go ahead and tell the commissioners that they were going to do this.
And I think our board also thought that it was solely within the responsibility of a corporation consistent with their fiduciary duties to make decisions with respect to who would serve in what position on the management team.
That did not sit well with Chairman Finley.
It's true. Your board can fire the CEO just like Berkshire Hathaway can fire Warren Buffett, as far as that's concerned. But in this particular context, there's a different set of rules that should apply here when this was an important feature of this merger. When we listened to what you said about what was going to happen, and we relied upon it.
They've settled it now. Jim Rogers is going to step down by the end of the year.
Wow. We didn't have time to talk about John Edwards' day in court. We didn't have time to talk about Paula Broadwell. Any more news to break, Michael? Dr. Michael Witzer from Catawba College, along with Julie Rose, Lisa Miller, Michael Tomczyk from WFAE News. Thank you all for being here.